This is Terry Crosby.
Andy Steiger.
Steve Kim.
Welcome to the AC Podcast. On this podcast, we want to help you understand and speak the language of our culture and address questions being asked with intellectual honesty, gentleness, and respect. So everybody just take a deep breath. There we go. We are in the middle or the beginnings of the conference weekend.
Everything is kicking off.
Everything's kicking off. Yeah. But we wanted to get a podcast in on the day that everything is kicking off.
I know.
Right? Like, why not?
Why not?
We didn't have anything else to do.
As though we weren't stressed enough as it is.
All right. So, yeah, we have a conference coming up tonight, tomorrow as well, and we are really looking forward to it, especially tonight. There's going to be a dialogue happening on freedom of religion, and our own Steve Kim.
Who's actually in the studio today.
He is in the studio. He's not in Alberta.
Good to have you with us.
Yeah, good to be here.
You're going
to
be moderating, so that's going to be fantastic.
Welcome back to beautiful British Columbia.
Oh, man, I miss the mountains.
Yeah. Switzerland of Canada, I tell you.
All right, so we are going to move on. We have a special guest today, and Andy will introduce him because they are some friends from a few years.
Yeah, we're BFFs.
BFFs. Yeah. All right.
Andrew's like, I don't know, actually.
There was some hesitation. There.
No, we have a very special guest in studio today. This is a guy who I met when I first started my PhD, getting into Polanyi and not quite sure what I was reading at times. And I thought, I need to talk to an expert. And so I, out of the blue, contacted Andrew Grosso. And Dr. Grosso was just very patient and made himself available to me. And we had many, many Skype conversations. And since we've known each other for about 4 years now, we've been to many conferences together and had the opportunity to do various things together. And now this is the first time having him at our conference. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Grosso.
Thanks very much. It's good to be here.
For those that are listening, where do you do ministry? Now, you used to work at Neshota House Seminary, and you were the academic dean.
That's right.
Okay, and now you're in South Carolina.
That's right. I'm in Columbia, and I'm the canon to the dean at Trinity Episcopal Cathedral there. And I've been there for not quite 2 years.
Great. The first thing I asked you when I saw you, because you do wear a collar, was whether or not you're Catholic, to which you told me, no, I'm not. And then I asked, are you married? And you said, yes. How long have you been married for?
Oh, we just celebrated our 20th anniversary last October, as a matter of fact. So we're working on 21.
Wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
It's amazing.
And now she's from Seattle?
That's right. She was born in California, but her father was career Navy, so they bounced around quite a bit. She spent some time in Italy and I think a few other places before they landed in Seattle, but she did most of her growing up there.
And where are you originally from?
I was born in Detroit, just a little north of the Detroit city line, and did most of my growing up in Michigan. And then, from there, went to Germany for a time, and then back to Michigan. And then went to Chicago to start my graduate work, and then Milwaukee, and then lived in Tennessee while I was in seminary, and then went out to Kansas, and then Wisconsin, and now South Carolina.
Now, here's a couple questions I've never asked you before. When did you get interested in academics? Now, just so our listeners know, Andrew's one of the brightest guys I've ever met, one of the most well-read and just culturally astute. So you can imagine why I'm happy to have him on here. But I am curious, you know, did you come out of the womb reading books? Or?
No, sir. No, you need to get out more. You think I'm one of the brightest people out there? Andy was looking for an expert on Polanyi, but they were all busy, so he called me. No, it was really my college experience, my experience as an undergraduate that I think awakened me to the scholarly vocation. I hadn't really ever been introduced to that before, and I didn't even really recognize what I was seeing while I was an undergraduate. I had the distinct privilege of being able to attend a Christian college as an undergraduate. I was at Calvin in Grand Rapids, and there were some very good people there at the time doing some very good work, but I had no idea what they were doing. I mean, I saw them doing it. It was very intriguing, very interesting to me, but I didn't know what to make of it because I'd never seen anything like it before. So after I graduated from Calvin, I spent a couple of years trying to figure out, well, what am I supposed to do with all of this? And I knew that college had been such an important, transformative time for me that I decided I needed to go back and do some graduate work. So that's when I applied to Wheaton near Chicago. And again, there were some people there doing Christian scholarship at a level that I'd never encountered before. But now I had more of a sense of what I thought it was they were doing, and I knew I wanted more of it. So I think it was probably my experience at Wheaton, and even more specifically, it was a seminar that was organized by Mark Knoll, who was still at Wheaton at the time, in which he gathered a number of members of the faculty from different departments. I think we had some psychologists, a mathematician, somebody who studied rhetoric and communication, some historians. Alan Jacobs was still at Wheaton at the time, so he was there. And then a couple of graduate students and some undergraduate students. And the purpose of the seminar was to ask the question, what difference does it make to be a Christian as a scholar? So we basically spent the whole academic year just talking about each of our disciplines from the perspective of our faith and trying to make sense of how Christian faith informs the way you do history or mathematics or physics or whatever. That was really transformative for me.
I just want to say one thing. We had one of our speakers cancel on us. So we've had to ask Dr. Grasso to step in for a number of speaking engagements on the weekend. So, yeah, we really appreciate you being here. We really appreciate you stepping up because we did lose a speaker, and he was slated for a number of talks. But so, yeah,
I'm grateful for the privilege.
Now, did you grow up in an Episcopal church?
I did, actually. My family came into the Episcopal church through my grandfather, my mother's father. He and his siblings were orphaned at a fairly young age. And he took up residence in the basement of an Episcopal church that allowed him to live there while he was working as a sexton for the parish. So he basically served as a janitor, and he sang in the choir there. And that's what brought my family into the Episcopal church. And my mother was born, and I was born in the Episcopal. And over the course of my life, I've had an opportunity to worship in other traditions. I was worshiping in the Christian Missionary Alliance for a while, the Reformed tradition when I was in Calvin. I never was quite comfortable identifying with those traditions. And then when I came back to the Episcopal Church and to Anglicanism, I realized, okay, this is who I am. This is home.
It's interesting when you and I go for dinner together, often the waitress will refer to you as father.
All right.
You must get that a lot. I'm wondering, though, just for our listeners, that might be curious, why the white collar?
I wear the collar for exactly the reason that you just mentioned. I find that it opens doors and it opens up conversations that I otherwise wouldn't have with people. If I go to a restaurant or if I go sit on an airplane or if I'm, you know, wherever I am, and I'm not wearing clericals, then people pretty much just ignore me, which is fine. I don't mind that. But I'm not bold enough in my proclamation of the gospel to be able to initiate conversations with people. But if I'm wearing the collar, then my boldness is really kind of beside the point because people will come up to me and will start talking to me.
They will actually approach you.
They will. Yeah,
and
they
start asking you questions.
That's right.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, we had it actually out in Colorado where we were having dinner.
Yeah.
And the waitress asked us to pray for her.
That's right.
Because she was going through some difficult stuff.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. And those kinds of opportunities just don't present themselves if I'm walking around in civvies. Mm. So, yeah, it's just about every time I go out, you know, in clericals, if I'm traveling or wherever, people will always acknowledge that in some way, shape, or form.
I've always been curious when people approach you, what's the sort of the general temperature? Because, I mean, we're going to be talking about freedom of religion and things like that tonight. And the sense that a lot of Christians get is that the general culture is just really hostile against the Christian faith. But in your experience, as people approach you, seeing that collar that you have, what's the sort of the general temperature?
I've never been approached by anybody who's been angry at me for wearing the collar, but my guess is that's because people who are angry at the church probably don't approach me. Mm. If someone approaches me, they either have a question or they have a spiritual need and they want prayer, or there's something that they associate enough of their experience of faith with the church to recognize that I'm potentially someone who might be able to address whatever need it is they have. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I can do that. Oftentimes I can't, just given the limitations of the time that I have with them and the relationship that I have with them. But I can always listen, and I can always try to give whatever answer is available to me at the time, and I can always pray with people. Mm-hmm. And I'm always happy to do that.
Well, after the podcast, we might be able to set up a confessional for Terry. We don't know what it's like working with this man.
You mean I confess to him?
Hey, let's move on here into the topic that we want to get into. In my studies into Michael Polanyi, you quickly come across some really great insights that this man had. And one of them is something that he refers to as a moral inversion. And that's the topic that we have today. We want to, first of all, just talk about what in fact is a moral inversion. And as we discuss this more, we're going to ask the question, are we heading into a moral inversion, or what sorts of inversions do we need to be cautious of in our culture today? Mm-hmm. So why don't we just begin with a definition of what is a moral inversion?
Polanyi uses moral inversion as a shorthand way of describing the consequences of what he thinks happens when we take a transcendent goal or a transcendent ambition or a transcendent value and project it into an immanent frame. So, for example, traditionally, the three transcendentals, the true, the good, and the beautiful, have all been goals or aspirations or desirable things that the culture was oriented to. We needed some sense of the good. We needed some sense of how to create beauty and how to make beauty manifest in our lives. We needed some sense of how to talk reasonably about the truth. And we used God and we used the idea of transcendence as a way of grounding and ordering our ideas about the true, the good, and the beautiful. And for many hundreds of years, that worked very well. One of the things that happens in the modern period is that all of those goals and aspirations get transposed into an immanent frame, because the expectation is that we no longer need to rely on the supernatural. We no longer need to rely on any understanding of
transcendence. Let's define that real quick here. What do you mean by immanent frame?
An immanent frame is one that is basically bounded by the parameters of history and physical reality. Oh, so the idea that reality itself is nothing more than that which can be perceived through empirical science, the idea mm-hmm. that progress, moral progress, philosophical progress, intellectual, social, political progress can all be defined in purely historical terms. And it's the expectation that within that frame that is wholly immanent to our experience, we can and indeed should and indeed must find ways of pursuing the goals that we have for ourselves relative to our understanding of truth, goodness, and beauty, because we know we need those goals, but we know that it no longer works to rely or refer in any way to a supernatural horizon to ground them.
So how about an example like this? Would this describe what you're talking about? So for example, I'm very much interested in ethics, meta-ethics, and things like that. And whereas in the past, we used to ground morality in God and God's nature, now we've come to a place where a lot of it is being explained away by sociobiological evolution. Rather than something transcendent like God, mm-hmm. now we're looking at something very much more imminent, like basically particles configuring themselves in certain ways.
Or pragmatism.
Right. Something like, or utility or personal or group preference, those mm-hmm. kinds of things. So you see that kind of breakdown of doing away with the transcendent and trying to explain everything through the immanent. Would that be a good example of that?
Yeah, that is. The first thing that has to happen when you transpose a transcendent value into an immanent frame is you have to figure out where you're going to ground it. What is this thing we're talking about if it's not something that refers to God or refers to any kind of transcendent horizon? Are we talking about a physical process that we can understand through the empirical sciences? Are we talking about a political process? Are we talking about a historical dynamic? Is this sociocultural? Is this linguistic? Is it a what is going on here? Is it a matter of gender? How does our particular perspective on the world inform the way that we apprehend whatever it is we're after? Mm. And the search for the ground of or the source of the true, the good, and the beautiful within an immanent frame has been an abiding preoccupation of the Western intellectual project ever since we decided that we could no longer use the transcendent mm-hmm. to ground that stuff.
So when do you think this shift happened? Like, would you say around the Enlightenment? What was the process and how are we at this point in time now?
It comes and goes. The more I think about the historical dynamics that play out as we, try and track the way in which ideas influence other ideas and the way that culture shifts and grows, I'm increasingly disinclined from saying that we can plot a straight, clear line from, you know, this particular point to that particular point and say, okay, well, the obvious, you know, line of progression here looks like this. I think things tend to come in waves.
Right. And they overlap as well.
That's right. And they tend to go in cycles. And, you know, what's happening philosophically may not necessarily mirror what's happening politically, and what's happening politically may not mirror what's happening scientifically. You know, so having said that, I think the I don't know if you want to, you know, line in the sand is kind of a dramatic and probably over precise term, but sometime around the emergence of nominalism, William of Ockham gets trotted out a lot these days. A number of people, Louis Dupré, I'm thinking of, Thomas Pfau, I'm thinking of, Charles Taylor does this a little bit. A lot of people will look back to William of Ockham as kind of the harbinger of this worldview, of a worldview that no longer needs to refer to a transcendent, which is interesting because Ockham himself was, of course, a Christian, and was, of course, very committed to the idea of God. But the thing that Ockham does is prioritize volition, right? Ockham puts a premium on the exercise of the will as a way of making sense of how the true, the good, and the beautiful come into existence. And when that gets transposed into an immanent frame, then volition becomes, the exercise of will becomes kind of key to understanding purpose and key to understanding human identity. But again, once that's disconnected from God, it spins out of control.
And I think that this is an important point that we need to, that we're getting at and that needs to be teased out here, is that a moral inversion is not a good thing. This is, it's where something inverts on itself and a very either benign or positive, you know, desire can turn in on itself and become something quite negative. And so for Polanyi, for those who don't know him, he was a scientist. First of all, he was a physician and then became a physical chemist. And he was at the top of his game back in the day. And one of the things that concerned him and ultimately would lead him into going into philosophy is he was beginning to see how the ideologies of the day were beginning to turn in on themselves, and where science at one point, you know, started out with these great ambitions, had turned so far on itself that it was destroying itself, that now you had a science that couldn't support a scientist. Right. And this is what ultimately, one of the things that's leading him to say, whoa, we're going to need to do something about this. I mean, what once started good is now turning bad.
Yeah, that's right. And it's important. I mean, the point you just made about the extent to which moral inversion is grounded in moral passion. It's not grounded in a rejection of morality. It's grounded in an overcommitment almost to morality. It's grounded in the expectation that because we can no longer expect God or any kind of transcendent reality to save us, it's incumbent on us to save ourselves.
Now, isn't totalitarianism a good example of this?
Right.
Most you know, countries aren't going, hey, we want to be totalitarian. You know, right, we want to just destroy the people, right? But what happens is this good desire, you know, for whatever it might be, then becomes at whatever cost to make that happen.
That's right.
And now you become the very thing you didn't want to be in the beginning.
Yeah. A couple of examples that I'm thinking of is mostly in the 20th century, right? The bloodiest century that we've seen. Mm-hmm. I look at what Adolf Hitler was trying to do. And I mean, in a sense, like, he had a really good kind of motive, if you will, or good intention of cleaning up the human gene pool. But what that ended up doing was, you know, the massacre of millions of people. And also because I grew up in South Korea and I grew up with very much, you know, in my mind, communism was very prominent and I was very much aware of what communism has done. And when you talk to communists, like, you know, when you look at Fidel Castro or Joseph Stalin, they are all for the people. Fidel Castro often talked about, there was this myth going around that he always wore this bulletproof vest, but he proudly said, no, I don't wear a bulletproof vest. What I wear is this moral vest. Mm. I am against the tyranny of the capitalists. I am for the people. But look at what communism has done, right?
Mao Zedong, same thing. Very much a man for the people, right? But then it began to turn in on itself, where then it began, whatever I have to do for the people, even if that means destroying them.
Well, that's, I think Polanyi suggests that the real outcome of moral inversion, the ultimate consequence of moral inversion, is when you put aside the goals that are initially justify the revolutionary fervor that you bring to your political project or your economic project or your intellectual project. You put aside those goals and you commit yourself to revolution for its own sake. and you no longer care. Transgression is now the imperative, right? It's it's no longer a matter of moving towards a particular goal, because you've come to recognize that the goals can't really be justified in a wholly immanent framework, right? You can't use history or culture or science or politics or any of those things to really provide a fulsome foundation for talking about the true, the good, or the beautiful. But yet, the commitment to progress is such that you can't back down. So now it's violent revolution all the time for its own sake.
Which is exactly what he saw in Hungary. He saw this in World War I, World War II.
That's right.
And again, this is very much what he's reacting to, because he witnessed this moral inversion, and it cost him friends and family.
Right. Yep.
Now, I want to take a moment here, though, and to push back on this, and I'm curious how you would respond to this, because it would seem as though Christianity had its own moral inversion that led to the Reformation. And ultimately, you have this moment where, you know, the Enlightenment is taking place, where people are pushing back on the power of the church that was being abused. Now, maybe you wouldn't see that as a moral inversion, and I don't know if you ever thought about that, but how would you respond to what the church went through that was leading into the Enlightenment?
Yeah, I'd have to think some more about that. I'm not sure. I'm just going to make this up off the top of my head. I'm not sure that I would incline to say that the Reformation comes about as a consequence of the church's response to early modernity. I think I would be more inclined to say that the Reformation comes about as a response to tensions manifest within the church itself.
And I would agree, and that's what I'm trying to get at.
Okay.
It seems as though there's like a moral inversion that's happening with tradition, where tradition is what starts out as a good thing. And it's interesting because Polanyi comes along and he wants to bring back tradition. He doesn't right. see a problem with tradition.
Right.
But what you see in the church, it seems to me, is a tradition that's gone out of control.
Well, that's okay. I'm going to have to start naming names here now. Here's where it gets uncomfortable.
everyone brace yourself.
Wrap yourselves in. You must be this tall to ride this ride. Oh man! So initially, you know, the initial reformers, they're not rejecting tradition. They're arguing about the proper interpretation of tradition. Luther doesn't want to let go of tradition. Calvin doesn't want to let, you know, none of those people, you know, Wycliffe doesn't want to let go of tradition. They're saying, we've lost the tradition, right? We got to go back to the tradition. We got to go back to the sources and go back to the origin of the church and get rid of all these later accretions that are getting in the way of the tradition. If there's a point in the church itself where that move becomes suspect, I would suspect that it probably emerges somewhere within kind of the fringes of the Anabaptist movement, right? When institutionalism itself becomes perceived as an evil, right? And tradition itself becomes perceived as an evil. And the manifest presence and ministry of the Holy Spirit in the life of the individual believer right now becomes the basis and the ground on which we justify Christian faith and Christian practice. If I don't need to refer to the church or the tradition, or even in some cases the scriptures, to justify the way that I express my faith, then we might be talking about something like, you know, a Christian form of inversion.
But it is interesting, because you do see this. I've seen this in my time pastoring, that you see this actual understanding that tradition isn't a bad thing.
Right.
You know, and you start to see this willingness to start to embrace more tradition, right? And it's interesting, because, you know, you find yourself in this balancing act between those. Now, I want to press forward here as we continue to discuss this. This is something you and I have talked a bit about, and this is a live conversation. So Dr. Grosso and I have been talking through this, and that is one of the things that you clued me into that I really appreciated was that as you look at going into the Enlightenment, that we've moved from an authoritative statement being a theological statement pre-Enlightenment to an authoritative statement being a scientific statement.
Right.
Now, you and I, and right now, we've been having a discussion where we've been really talking about moral inversions within a, you know, Enlightenment worldview. But as you and I have been talking about, I believe that we've been in the last 70 years in a transition period where we're moving into what I would call a neo-Enlightenment. And I think no longer do we live in a society in which a scientific statement is an authoritative statement. I think less and less will somebody seek to make that argument. And more what you're seeing is that a legal statement is now becoming an authoritative statement. It seems to me then, if that being the case, that there is a whole host of moral inversions that wait for us ahead if we're not careful.
Yeah, I think what the dynamic that you're describing, I think, is what happens when the culture begins to wake up to the fact that they don't really have a good foundation for talking in any kind of objective way about moral truth or really any kind of truth, and need something to ground their conversation, right? How are we going to organize ourselves as a society, and how are we going to contribute to the common good if we don't have some means available to us to talk about what that good looks like? And who's going to do that for us? Well, the courts, right? I mean, the courts are clearly the instrument that's in place, and maybe the legislature to a certain extent, you know, representative democracy, and we'll send people to Washington and wherever, we'll send people to Ontario, and they'll vote for us, right? And they'll put laws into place that the courts will then interpret, and we'll come up with a juridical means, a means based in the exercise of reason, the exercise of law, which itself is presumed to be guided by the exercise of reason, and everything will be above board, and everything will be, you know, purely objective, at least as objective as we can possibly make it. And we won't need to worry about appealing to authorities or standards or traditions or practices that are not part and parcel of the common cultural context in which we all recognize ourselves and find ourselves to be.
Now, it seems to me that this is ripe for a moral inversion. And I think that we've been in this for a while where we have legal systems that really are foundationless. For example, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights will say that, you know, humanity has inherent dignity, equality, you know, inalienable rights. But anyone who's read that document knows that there's no support given for that whatsoever. Really, this is just, you know, a law above the law, this moral posit that's made, but no foundation given for it. Seems to me that that becomes quite dangerous, because anybody then can vie for that power, where you begin to use the legal system at any means to push what you are convinced is true.
Yeah, you figure out where the levers of power are, and then you just start pulling until you get the combination you want. The distinction that I think always needs to be kept in mind, though, is that the fact that we're having trouble as a culture talking about the foundations of moral reasoning doesn't necessarily itself imply that the legal framework that we use to organize our life together likewise has no foundation. It's only when we collapse legal reasoning and moral reasoning together that the lack of foundation for one becomes a problem for the other.
Now, I think where you're going here is you would probably argue that a Judeo-Christian worldview is in fact the foundation that we've laid for the legal practice of the West?
Yeah. I'd say historically speaking and culturally speaking, I don't know that, you know, there's any real serious, robust argument to be entertained apart from the idea that many of our legal practices and many of our legal assumptions rest upon foundations that themselves owe something to the Judeo-Christian tradition.
So now here, this is where I think we can start to see these moral inversions then begin to take place. Whereas once you start to walk away from that foundation and you find yourself more and more foundationless in this, and you see how effective it is. It's been very effective, by the way, the UDHR, and to say that humans are born with inherent dignity is very effective. So effective that we now have this desire to see animals brought into inherent dignity. In 2017 in New Zealand, a river was given personhood status, right? You're seeing Sophia, a machine, given citizenship to Saudi Arabia this, you know, in 2017 as well. And now all of a sudden, you know, you seem to see this, well, it's good, right? And, you know, inherent dignity is good. Well, let's just give inherent dignity to everything.
Right. Yeah, that's the revolution at all costs kind of playing itself out. Once you start down that road, then you pretty much have to begin assigning dignity to everything that moves, you know, and some things that don't, simply because that's what's required. I mean, the logic of the argument requires that you recognize whatever particular value it is you're pursuing, whether it's dignity or whatever, you've got to begin applying that as indiscriminately as you possibly can, because that's the basis on which you justify your action.
And what once made us unique is no longer there.
Right.
And I find it really ironic that critics of Christianity will tell Christians that you use God to justify all of your moral actions or immoral actions. But I look at this and I go, you're doing the exact same thing, except you're using inherent dignity for everything that you want to justify, you're using that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's something there that connects to something that I heard Andy say just a few minutes ago about the way in which the commitment to dignity is kind of sui generis. You know, it's taken as self-authenticating and self-validating. There's something profoundly theological about that. Mm-hmm. What you've got there is you've got another transposition of a principle that, historically speaking, was previously thought to exist only in the transcendent realm, namely in God, the only being that exists necessarily and in any kind of self-sufficient and self-evident way is God, and everything else depends on God. When that goes away, something else will appear as the self-evident, you know, self-justifying, self-sufficient principle for justifying action.
It seems that when you remove that transcendent, right, all you have is just a collection of particular things. And there's nothing really tying them together. How do you pull them together as a coherent whole, not just as a collection of parts, right?
Yeah, this is Plato's attempt to wrestle with the problem of the relationship between the one and the many. You know,
right.
How do I hold on to the unity of all things while also recognizing the diversity of all things? You know, what is it that distinguishes human persons from other non-human entities? And what is it that distinguishes one human person from another human person? Mm-hmm. And how do I recognize their essential connectedness and relatedness while also recognizing that they're distinct? Does one or the other of those have some kind of illusory appearance to me that isn't actually true? Is everything just many, or is everything just one? And how do I put those two things together?
Well, as we wrap up here, I think it'd be helpful just to wrap up, Andrew, by asking, you know, what do you see as the Christian responsibility in the age to come as we continue to move forward rapidly into the future ahead? How do we avoid moral inversions, or what is the Christian response?
I think it's going to be increasingly incumbent on the church to find ways of testifying to the gospel with our lives, by which I'm not necessarily referring to martyrdom here, but we're going to have to show people what the Christian life looks like. We can talk till we're blue in the face, but if we can't demonstrate in the relationships that we have with our fellow Christians amongst ourselves, if we can't show the difference that belief in Christ makes relative to the relationships that people share between one another, if we can't demonstrate the kind of reconciliation that Paul talks about when he talks about the ministry of reconciliation that God undertakes in Jesus Christ and then gives to us, if we can't demonstrate that, then all the talk in the world is not going to help. Mm. But if we can show people that, if we can give people a lived example of what that looks like, then people will be willing to hear whatever we have to say, right? Because that demonstration of a lifestyle will run so contrary to everything else that we're seeing around us that people will see us and will say, they're doing something different, and I want to be part of that.
Mm-hmm. I do think it's interesting as we move into this, you know, legal authority, that the Christianity has so much to offer here, particularly because, you know, you often find pushback, Steve, like, and we get this quite often, mm-hmm. to something like divine to command theory or something like that.
Right.
And,
yeah.
You know, seeing God as that moral authority, right. But we have a culture right now looking for a moral authority. It's just, you got everyone wanting to be that moral authority. Right. And so it's kind of this interesting opportunity where people want to do good, mm-hmm. right? And they want to make a difference, mm-hmm. and whatnot. And I think that's why you get so many social justice warriors,
oh, yeah.
right, these days.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the problem is they need somebody that can help them see where it's going astray, how this is turning in on itself. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is something that Christianity throughout history has had a vital part in culture, where with you know, seeking to kind of guide, mm-hmm. Well, at least to be a buffer when culture starts to go astray, mm-hmm. and to be a pushback, mm-hmm. towards something more balanced. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think too, this might be the point at which martyrdom may come into the picture, because I think another thing that the church historically has had and has been able to bear witness to is the expectation that at the end of the day, it is God who's going to sort this out, and that we can entrust ourselves to God even if others are committing injustices against us. Oftentimes, that witness can be a very powerful, you know, the seed of the church is the blood of the martyrs, is the kind of the traditional saying there. Now, that doesn't mean that we have to necessarily die for our faith. Some are called to that, right? But it does mean that when we're called to bear brokenness, You know, Paul says, look, if the choice is between scandalizing the gospel or having someone take advantage of you, why not be wronged? You know, why not let someone take advantage of you? If making the point that no one's going to take advantage of you is going to hinder your ability to proclaim the gospel, sure, let them take advantage of you. Let them execute injustice against you. Because in doing so, you will heap burning coals on their head, right? I mean, I'm putting two verses together there. Yeah. But Paul there is bearing witness to his expectation that at the end of the day, it's not him that's going to sort it out. It's not his responsibility. It's God who's going to sort it out. And that he's willing to entrust himself to God just the way that Christ entrusted himself to God.
And that maybe it's going to require something that extreme in order that they'll see the injustice.
That's right.
So I was listening to you earlier in a talk just a couple hours ago, and you were referring to the aesthetics of the Christian faith and how we move forward. That's going to be a big piece within proclaiming the gospel.
Yeah.
Could you elaborate just a little bit on that and how the church should, kind of move forward with that?
Yeah. As we think about the importance that there's other people who've done a lot of work on this. I'm thinking of David Schindler here. Hans-Urs von Balthasar certainly paid a lot of attention to the importance of beauty and the aesthetics and the aesthetic dimension of theology. There's a number of people who've appropriated Balthasar's work and others. Beauty is increasingly, I think, recognized as, in some respects, an even more fundamental category than the true or the good, because it is primarily through our experience of the beautiful, that we recognize the true or the good. We may or may not necessarily initially see something as true, but we might recognize it as beautiful. And if we recognize it as beautiful, we're going to be drawn to it. And if we're drawn to it, then maybe we'll come to recognize it as true as well. Now, what I'm not suggesting there is that the true, the good, and the beautiful are separate from one another. They're merely different dimensions of one unified reality. But it is the attractiveness of the beautiful. Another way of putting that would be, it is the glory of the Lord that first calls us forward, right? Mm-hmm. And when we respond to that glory, right, we recognize, oh, this is the one in whom truth and goodness are to be found, as well as beauty. Mm-hmm. So finding ways to bear witness to beauty in everything that we do, finding ways to bear witness to beauty in our worship, making our worship as glorious and majestic as we possibly can, making the lives that we cultivate amongst ourselves as beautiful as we possibly can, cultivating an aesthetic that is grounded in an awareness of the ongoing presence of God, sanctifying and thereby beautifying the life of the world by beautifying the life, the lives of the members of his body, is what I think that's about.
Yeah, that is great. Well, we appreciate you coming on the podcast,
Dr. Thank
Grasso.
Thank you.
And this has been fantastic. So we got a day coming up. Tonight we kick off the conference. Thank you for joining us, listeners, the AC Podcast of the Ministry of Apologetics Canada. And we'll come back next week with more things to think about.